Hello, welcome to Twist and Sprout, episode number 5. I'm Carl Group, your host, and we're here at Basavern Community Farm for an episode entitled Field to Fork. We've got with us today Hugh Taylor. I was going to say Hugh Grant.
We could role play.
No one knows my surname.
We've got with us here today Hugh Taylor, head grower, and his assistant or volunteer, Rebecca?
Ellis.
Who's joining us today to talk about the philosophy, the components, and what's involved in moving from field to fork. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Thank you.
Before we start off, we always like to ask, what is your favorite vegetable and how do you like to cook it?
Yeah, so I definitely went for the tomato, particularly the sun gold tomato, my personal favorite. And I just love tomatoes. I love picking them and eating them straight off the vine.
Okay, Rebecca?
And I love aubergines. Partly because I find them really surprising when I see them on the plant. And I love to add a lot of flavour, like in a curry. Quite spicy.
Okay. Mm. Tomatoes and aubergines are our pick of the day.
And they grow together in the polytunnel.
Ah, right.
And you can make parmigiana with both of them.
Yeah, imagine that.
So today's topic, from field to fork, Hugh, would you like to just expand on that? What does that actually mean?
From field to fork means... Well, in my opinion, it means having a very short supply line from where the veg is grown to the people who are actually eating it, which in our case is always within about 10 miles, rather than veg travelling halfway around the world to get to you.
Okay.
It's also about investing in your local area, and if you're buying your produce from as local as possible, you're supporting local jobs and supporting local people. And for us, it's about also supporting this local project where it's not all about money, it's about people connecting with the land and people meeting together socially on the farm. And it's just that social network that we've built here, our volunteers and our customers and our members and all the people involved here. It's a big investment, and by buying our vegetables you're investing in that.
I would just like to say, in terms of someone who's relatively recently moved here, it's really, really interesting hearing the way people in the community talk about the farm and how they value it as an asset that is kind of here, and it's part of us. It's part of the land here. It's deeply, deeply valued. There's an identity around it in this landscape and in the human community as well.
Three main restaurants, cafes that we supply, one in St. Joe's, one in Mousel, and one up near Zenner. So we work with those three chefs. Try and work out what they want from what they buy from us every week.
Right.
And I think the most local one is the Dog and Rabbit in St. Just. They buy the most from us, mainly our salad, because they absolutely adore our salad. The fresh leaves, which we manage to grow pretty much 12 months of the year, although there's a few ups and downs. But we do produce salad most of the year round, and Dog and Rabbit is a big customer of ours. They'll have 2 or 3 kilos a week. And we'll get it up there twice a week for them. But that salad is also in all our veg boxes. At the moment, about 80 boxes a week. And it's in at the market stalls and available in the shop as well. That's a big thing we do. So our veg boxes go out every Friday. Virtually all the veg in them is grown here on the farm. Not quite all, but most of it. There's some stuff that we can't quite manage to get here like we would like, and which other parts of the UK are better at growing than we are. At the moment, that's carrots. They like a sandier soil. So we're actually bringing them in, organic carrots from Lancashire at the moment, although it has also been Suffolk recently, but they are certified organic. And that, at the moment, is the only bought-in veg in the veg boxes. All the rest is ours, grown here on the farm, mainly by our wonderful team of volunteer helpers.
So if we look at the salad as an example, what are the qualities of the salad grown locally versus the qualities being brought in if a restaurant was to buy in from a larger, you know, national chain?
So if we're looking at the example of salad, our salad is grown without any artificial inputs, any artificial fertilizers. And I've actually got some notes here on this. So I've put here that in agriculture, synthetic fertilisers are the main source of greenhouse gases. It's not carbon, It's nitrous oxides, but it's equivalent to the entire global aviation and shipping combined.
Oh.
It's just from artificial fertilizer.
Gosh.
So it's 2.6 gigatons of carbon equivalent per year. So if you're buying your salad from us, we don't use artificial fertilizer. We use horse muck and our own compost.
Right.
On the salads. That's a big thing. The salad is picked here on the farm, and it's in the Dog and Rabbit in St. Just on the plates the next day, or it's in our shop on the same day, or in the at the market the following day. So it hasn't lost its nutritional value, because nutritional value decreases over time from picking. So the nutritional value will remain high because it's such a short supply chain.
Right.
And so fresh. But also, if you buy your bag of salad from a supermarket, for example, it's probably packed in plastic, and the plastic will have a protective atmosphere inside, which is carbon dioxide.
Okay.
And we don't do that. We have a box of salad, and you have a pair of tongs, and you put it into a paper bag and buy it and take it home. So we're avoiding that plastic, we're avoiding that carbon dioxide, and we're avoiding the greenhouse gases from the production of the salad and also the transport.
Yeah, just to add to that, one of the things that makes the salad so delicious, whether you are eating it at home or on a plate at the Dog and Rabbit,
mm-hmm.
is not only that it's so fresh, as Hugh says, but there's an extraordinary diversity of salad plants grown here.
Right.
So this morning we've just been growing, we've been planting out Chinese leaves and giant red mustard, for example. And I'd never heard of giant red mustard. So mm-hmm. you have, I don't know, would you say like 10 different types of leaves in a bag, something like that? It feels like that when I'm making a salad.
At the moment it's probably about 10. It varies through the year, it varies
right.
with season. So when the daylight is decreasing, like at the moment, we're predominantly brassica salad vegetables, like rocket and the mustards, and when the daylight is increasing in the spring, for example, our leaves in the veg boxes, for example, are lettuce based,
right.
lettuce and spinach based, because they like it daylight increasing. So the salad varies through the year. It's a seasonal aspect of salad production, and indeed all vegetable production. It varies through the seasons. So if you're buying your veg in season, that a better chance of it coming from your local area or from the country you live in than if you're buying it out of season. And did you know that only 50% of the vegetables we eat in the UK are actually grown in the UK? 50%. And the other 50% are brought in, mainly from Europe, but not just from Europe. They come from Morocco, they come from Kenya, they
right.
come from East Africa, they come from around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of air miles, a lot of carbon output to get those onto your plate.
Is there an argument for those that are saying, you know, well, I want my avocado, I want, you know, any of these more exotic vegetables or fruits or vegetables?
Obviously, we try and get as much variety into boxes as we can. But it depends on what's been successful on the farm that
right.
year, that growing season, what's available that week. This year has been a particularly difficult year in the vegetable growing wise. I've had quite a lot of failures, mainly due to slugs and rain and not enough sunlight. But we have had some amazing successes. So we've had a load of onions, really good onions this year, and rainbow chard and tomatoes. They've been really good, but they've been in our boxes every week, along with potatoes. So this year, there might not be the variety that people are used to. But there's nothing wrong with buying our veg box and then topping up with the other stuff that you want.
Mm-hmm.
from out of your local shops. I think our veg boxes are very colourful at the moment, mainly because of the rainbow chard and all the different colours of stem of rainbow chard. And it's one of those amazing, versatile vegetables that you just don't get in supermarkets or grocery stores. And there's such a lot you can do with it. We had a lovely dish yesterday cooked by our Colombian woofer, and it was charred, simmered with eggs and cheese, and then put in the oven, I think, and it was so good.
Right.
One of my particular favourites is the recipe I got from Mada Jaffrey, and it's a turnip and kidney beans recipe. And people mock turnips, so sounds like a good band name, the mock turnips. people do mock turnips, but they do grow well, and there are good things you can do with them, like coleslaw. And Mother Jaffrey's got an amazing recipe, which I look forward to every year when it's turnip season, cooked with kidney beans, served with rice and lime pickle. It's one of my favourites. But like you're saying with seasonal vegetables, there's something exciting I find, and I'm a vegetable fanatic, which is lucky. But there's something really exciting about seasonal vegetables, and when it's coming into purple sprouting broccoli season, and people are like coming into the shop going, "Have you got any purple sprouting broccoli yet?" And it's like, "Oh, maybe next week. And there's a real like excitement about it happening, and also with tomato season, when you get your first tomatoes in June and they're so good off the vine, and you just got a few in the shop, and that's an exciting time. And then this morning we've just harvested our squash, and that's another thing, just before Halloween, to harvest your squash is an exciting time, and you get the crown prince in the shop, and they're looking amazing on the shelves. Here on the farm, we for 2 days a week, we're extremely fortunate to have a cook, a local man who comes and cooks for us twice a week. And I've seen him this morning. He comes in and he goes into the packing shed. He looks at our reject pile.
Oh, reject.
All the grayed out.
I didn't know we were eating the rejects.
So he looks at the reject pile at 10:30, and at 1 o'clock he's served up a lunch for like 10, 15 people cooked out of those rejects. And it's always good.
It's completely
and sometimes
delicious.
It's amazing.
Right.
And those are the things that we don't think are good enough to go in our veg boxes.
Okay.
So today he's got peppers, he's got some mustard greens, potatoes. I'm not going to say we specialise in wonky veg, but we have a better tolerance for vegetables that don't look as perfect as you might expect them to.
Have you tasted any of... You must have tasted.
That's the only reason I come to the farm, is for the lunches.
Does the farm do any sort of cooking workshops?
Well, our cook at the moment will take someone under his wing for the morning.
Oh.
We've got one of our local volunteers is in there with him this morning.
Okay.
Doing some KPing.
Some people who buy veg boxes seem to have an appreciation of the whole year and the ups and downs seasonally, and kind of want to be part of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Vicariously connected.
Vicariously connected, that's a really great way of putting it. And then there are some people who kind of want to cherry pick and want to come in when literally the cherry tomatoes are delicious and the aubergines are delicious, like in the summer and the autumn.
You've got to try and mix and match and do the best you can.
Right.
So if people are really crying out for a particular veg, you've got to try and grow it.
Mm-hmm.
It might work, it might not. There might be a good reason why you weren't growing it.
Right.
Or there might be a good reason why it keeps failing. Mm. You've got to try, and if you can't do it, then there might be somebody in the local area who is doing it. Although if you can't do it, there probably isn't in the local area, so somewhere a bit further afield.
I just think it's a massive responsibility.
Oh, yeah. 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 There's a lot that Hugh actually, everything from mapping out and figuring out the distribution on Fridays to deciding what's going to grow, in the next season.
And then he teaches all of us.
Yeah, that too.
Everything he knows, or some of it.
I try as I'm rushing past.
I've noticed that you do more of that now.
That's good.
Yeah, definitely, since I started here.
Now, if we can go down that path a little bit, Rebecca. What have you taken away since you've come on board here and volunteered your time?
Sure. So I've been coming for about 2.5 years.
Okay.
And when I arrived here, I didn't know anything about planting or harvesting veg at all. And one of the reasons I came is because we moved down here and we have a garden and I want to grow my own veg.
Right.
And I thought, okay, I'll come to the farm and learn about that. So I've learned a lot about the different stages and how much goes into production. I've learned specifically that if you put a fork vertically down into I can't think of what they're called, a line of potatoes, a ridge of potatoes, you're likely to spear the potatoes with the fork and they're not going to be very good to sell.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go in, it's taken me 2.5 years to learn this, I'm not a very fast learner. But if you put the fork in sideways, somehow you avoid piercing the potatoes. You have all these beautiful whole potatoes. So there's a specific thing I've learned.
Well, there's gardening tip number one.
and just socially, what I've learned is I suppose I'm quite a loner. I quite mm-hmm. like my own company, and I did not come here for social reasons.
Right.
And I have really enjoy the social aspect of being in the fields together with local volunteers living here in Cornwall, and then with the international and UK-based woofers as well.
Yeah, right.
I really love the crack. I really love the banter. And I suppose I've kind of learnt a little bit how to do that rather than shy away from it.
Mm-hmm.
I hope, anyway.
Right.
So you've learnt gardening tips and socialising tips.
A little bit. I have a lot of fun here.
And you come in how often?
Just once a week.
Only once a week?
Yeah.
Right, so that's quite a bang for your time, really.
Yeah, I'm dosed up.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. I think one of the great things here, because it's a community farm, we have lots of people coming, lots of volunteers, and we have woofers coming, and I learn from them.
Yeah.
And they learn from us as well. So it's a big educational and cultural exchange in both directions.
That's one of the things
that
I love.
They come with their ideas, and we take some of them on.
Do you? Mm.
So sort of the topic for today, Field to Fork. You know, I walked in thinking that it was just going to be a simple, direct, linear answer or topic to sort of unpack, but it is, I mean, in just this conversation so far, it's just how wide and varied and what it involves and how contextual it is.
One of the things I've learned that I find interesting is this approach to growing veg called no-dig.
No-dig.
No-dig. Mm-hmm. And there's this tool that we use here that I've never used before, which I just love. It's called a broad fork, where it's a massive fork that you have to jump on basically to get it into the soil, and then you just pull it back a bit, and so the earth is moved but without being dug. So in the polytunnel where we've been today planting out salad, there had been maybe even last week aubergine and tomato plants and basil plants there. And they have been harvested and then pulled out, and then nothing else really done. A little bit of weeding, and then just this broad fork put in before something else, like the salad leaves that we planted today.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that really surprising, because I would have thought, you know, traditionally you'd kind of dig up and churn it all around, add lots of compost, and then plant. And I'm interested to know from Hugh what the benefits are of no dig, because I've just been interested in that as a process, I suppose.
So just so we're clear, even on something as simple as a shovel, like, you just don't dig.
I always feel if I have dug with a shovel that am I going to have my knuckles wrapped?
Oh, because no dig for me always sort of, I have this vision of, you know, no dig, you don't bring a tractor through with a cultivator and dig everything up. But you're saying it even goes all the way down to just the human effort with a shovel. Is that part of the no dig philosophy?
Well, no dig is about not inverting the soil layers.
Okay.
So the soil's got different layers inside it, and they set themselves up naturally. And once you invert them, you're kind of messing with the soil, and you're breaking up the mycelium that the fungi have down inside there. And it's the mycelium and the fungi that feed the plants to a great extent.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're breaking that up, you're then destroying part of the soil's ability to provide nutrients to your plant. So like Rebecca was saying, one of the things that we've got, we last year we invested in two broad forks.
Okay. Can you describe, this isn't a pitchfork thing, is
it's,
it?
It's a lot wider than the pitchfork.
It's about a metre wide.
Oh, it's a metre wide.
It's 45 centimetres. I think it's 45 centimetres wide.
Okay.
But it's got five prongs on it, which are themselves probably 30, 40 centimetres long.
Okay.
And it's got two handles, one at each end of the 5-centimetre shaft and five tines at the bottom. And you dig it down into the ground, but then you just wobble it backwards and forwards.
Huh?
So you have to jump on it,
otherwise it doesn't go.
You kind of move it back, and you can see the soil lift a bit.
Okay.
Yeah. And then once it's done that, you push the fork back and take it out.
But you haven't disturbed
those
layers that you're...
So you've not inverted the layers at all.
Okay.
What you've done is aerate down into the ground. So not just the tines going in, but the actual lifting process has aerated the soil.
And then you might put some compost or manure on top of that sometimes.
Put the compost.
But like today, where we've been planting, there was no compost added.
We haven't done that today, no.
Okay.
So this is only...
We might do that later in the season.
So these are the kinds of conversations we might have. And so just organically, I might learn something from you, and all of us do.
Yeah. But this is earth, only vegetables that are growing below the earth, right? Or is this when you're coming to the time of year when you got to cultivate or...
Well, this was for planting salad, so they're growing above the ground, but their roots still need the good aeration down under the ground.
So this is a process used for everything? Everything that's growing? Or
not everything. So we have quite a few different systems. It's all a bit mix and match. So we have our polytunnels, which are no dig, and we use the board fork, and we probably go through each tunnel at least once a year with the board fork, and then we would add any compost we add onto the top of the ground. So the polytunnels are no dig. We have got some no dig areas outside. We've got some perennial beds outside, which aren't even board forked, of course, because they got perennial crops in like rhubarb and globe artichokes. And then we have some areas which are not no dig, but they're what's called minimum tillage.
Yeah.
Where you work the soil as little as you can get away with, but you still work it.
Right.
So I might actually go through there with the tractor once a year.
What would you grow on minimum tillage soil?
Well, we put our purple sprouting broccoli in, and we put our squash in and our courgettes into that.
Okay.
And in terms of yield, is there any noticeable difference, or this is simply just to make sure that the soil and its strata aren't disturbed? So you're not gaining anything more by doing this in the sense of a bigger yield, but you're keeping the health of the soil intact.
Well, you keep the health of the soil intact, you should get a bigger yield out of it.
Right, okay.
But there are some crops that you can't do this. Well, I'm going to say there's some crops you can't do it with, like potatoes, but there are ways of doing it with potatoes. Mm-hmm. No dig methods of potatoes, I've not tried them.
Mm-hmm.
Because we do an acre of potatoes and we do it all by tractor, and right, it's definitely digging, it's definitely tillage.
I just had this thought. We've been talking lots about vegetables in terms of field to fork, but you also have chickens on site. So does that fall into any sort of field to fork ethos?
Well, our chickens are an integral part of the farm and an integral part of our crop rotation, in that we have the market garden, which is 2 acres, and above there we have 2 fields, both of which are 2 acres, and they're both fenced in with chicken fencing. The chickens are in one of them for 2 years, then they go up to the other one for 2 years, then back down for 2 years, and up for 2 years. So they're on essentially a 4-year rotation.
Right.
And when they are not in the field, that's then becomes our main crop field. So we have our potatoes in there, and our field scale veg like kale and chard, and turnips and perpetual spinach, parsnips and swede. So that's our field scale, so which is on a 4-year rotation, along with the chickens, along with the potatoes, and they move through those 2 fields. The idea there being that the chickens, they get their fresh pasture because they're moving, but they will also eat quite a few of the insects, which are damaging to plants, and they will hopefully eat the slugs, which are damaging to the plants, but they will also do a lot of add a lot of manure, add a lot of fertilizer onto the ground for you to grow your crops on afterwards.
And the eggs are absolutely the best eggs.
Yeah, oh yeah, we love the eggs from here.
Yeah,
yeah, they are. Eggs. Yeah, there's a noticeable difference. Mm. Absolutely.
Well, traditionally farms would be small scale and they would be mixed, so they would grow a lot of different things on one farm, and they would have a rotation.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's lots of different reasons for rotations. The main one is disease in the crops.
Okay.
So if you have your chickens in the same field all the time, if the chickens get a sickness, then that sickness is in that field all the time. If you move them out of it, they're not pecking around in their own manure, so they're not picking up their own germs.
Right.
They'll move into fresh field. And it's the same with crops. If you have potato blight, it's a fungal spore, and it can go into the soil. And if you grow your potatoes in that soil, and the next year the fungal spore is already there waiting for them.
Oh, right.
So we have a 4-year rotation for our potatoes, and that's just good standard farming practice.
Yeah.
One way of avoiding having a good rotation is by using chemicals to kill off all the things that you don't want in your soil, and that way you can grow the same crop in the same soil year after year after year. Obviously we avoid that, and we have a good crop rotation. We have quite a flexible but complicated rotation, which even I can't begin to explain. But we have the two fields with the chickens and the main crop. And down in the market garden, we have five strips which rotate, and we have five polytunnels, and we have a rotation inside the polytunnels as well. So we do rotate, and mostly it's to keep disease and crop pests to a minimum. But other reasons to rotate, and one is the nutrient value. It's like one particular crop will take a lot of one particular nutrient, and then you want to have a crop in there which isn't relying on that nutrient or is actually replenishing that nutrient afterwards to rotate.
Right, okay. Is that, because you spoke about having your own garden, is that scalable? Is that something that would, you know, in a residential garden, even to the point of pots, yep. You know, that it's necessary to do this?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
Did you know that?
So my ears have just pricked up during listening to you, because I didn't know that much detail about rotations. I'm quite excited.
Yeah. It's especially on a scalable level. Like, that's something that
you... scalability, I didn't know.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
So a very basic crop rotation, I think, is the four-year rotation. And you could do it with square metre beds. Just have four beds, all of a square metre. And have your...
Oh, right.
Potatoes, your onions, your brassicas, and...
That's cool.
Your miscellaneous, or whatever.
That's neat.
Whatever way you want to work it. And I think what we pretty much do is we do legumes, because they fix nitrogen, followed by potatoes, which use a lot of nitrogen, followed by brassicas, followed by miscellaneous.
Mm.
So you mean you'd have four blocks and you'd go around in that way?
Yeah. Every season, just move it on a block.
So that's garden tip number two. Rotate your crops.
Well, I don't need to volunteer.
But there's lots and lots of different rotations. And that's just a very, very simple one.
Oh, okay.
I knew a farmer here who had a 13-year crop rotation between his fields.
Wow.
But a lot of...
13
years?
He
must have used a lot of...
Well, a lot of that was cattle.
Oh, okay.
And hay, and then crops, different crops, and there was actually a 13-year rotation.
Actually, there is a question I never thought of asking, is how much have you learned over the years from local farmers about what to do and about what maybe not to do?
Yeah, good question. I've definitely learned some from local farmers. I mean, the people I probably learned the most from was when I first came here, and the people who've been farming on this farm for 10 years live down the road.
Of course, yeah.
And so I spent a lot of time in their kitchen drinking coffee with a notepad and just going through all the stuff. And there's other people in the area who are doing, I hate to call it small-scale veg, but that's what it is, by modern standards anyway, small-scale veg. There's other market gardens in the area, and I've been to them and talked to them and learnt from them. But I do learn stuff from the big farmers as well, the contractors who come here and the people I know who are doing like 100 acres of brassicas.
Right.
You will learn stuff. You'll always learn stuff. Mm. And I hate to say it, but you might just learn how you don't want to do things.
Mm. Yeah.
It's still a good lesson.
Yeah. Rebecca, you had yours. Which you said earlier.
Pronging the potatoes.
Yeah, about learning about soil distribution and movement versus digging.
That was interesting.
Yeah, that was...
What about fertilising here?
Well, fertiliser, we use most of our fertiliser is our own compost. And a lot of our own compost is made from the chickens.
Let's...
So, not from the chickens themselves, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But from when we clean their sheds out once a week and
but
we bring all the manure out.
Can we just... Oops.
Sorry. I'm just thinking in terms of the tip. Do you think sometimes we over-fertilise? We feel we've got to chuck a lot of fertiliser at the soil? Or like today, like I said, we didn't fertilise anything. We didn't add anything to that soil.
No, but we are... Hopefully we're going to add a small layer of compost on the top of that soil. But yes, you are right. You can over-fertilise. And if you over-fertilise, if you put a load of manure or a load of compost down, it's very rich, you can damage your plants. If it's in physical contact, it can actually burn the plant.
Yeah, that kind
a lot
of thing.
Of
you see, I don't
there.
Know that kind
is
of thing.
Is that
really... Also, you if you over-fertilise, you can create an imbalance in the soil so that the microbes that live in the soil, one is out-competing another, like you've got too much bacteria, not enough fungi, and that can then produce an unhealthy soil if you've over-fertilised.
Can you over-compost?
It depends how rich your compost is.
Uh-huh.
So, We use a lot of compost from the Green Waste Company.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a few tons every year, and it is very infertile compost. We use it mainly as a mulch on the surface of the soil. It's very woody. It's more of a soil conditioner than a compost. But we use it, and it keeps the weeds down, and after a few years it will get the fungi in it and it will start to feed, but not at the very beginning.
So last week I asked Hugh, what kind of compost do you use here, because I was thinking about my own garden.
Yes.
And he explained this mm-hmm. about the Green Waste compost, and that's a really useful learning point.
Mm-hmm.
These different types of compost, the fact it was woody, all everything that you said. So this knowledge that Hugh has, he's spreading it.
Yeah.
Like compost.
But
my muck spreader.
The other thing that I've taken away over a few of these episodes now is also just the learning curve. Like, you know, just about trial and error. And I would think that also is going to be environmental or contextual. So wherever you live, like if you live down near the ocean versus in an urban environment, more of an agricultural environment, all of these places will have, you can't do one thing that will work there and transport it or transfer it to the other area and it'll do the same thing.
Even here from one year to the next.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's different.
It's different, isn't it? Like, what was the crop that was kind of ravaged by some kind of pest this year?
Oh, quite a few of them. So we've had lots of slug damage on the squash and the courgettes.
Mm.
So we had quite a good squash last year. Last year we got over 600 kilos of squash. And we just harvested this morning, it's 270 kilos of squash. So we're down to about 40% of what we did have.
Gosh.
And that's mainly due to slugs, which is mainly due to wet weather and a mild winter.
Since we are discussing a few garden tips here, is there anything else that sort of your top three or top five that sort of stick out? If you were to give a newbie gardener, or even someone with a bit of experience, that you'd like to share, Hugh? What keeps you motivated throughout the seasons?
My motivational drive. My main motivation is that I want this farm to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And I want the farm to keep on going and get better and get stronger and get more resilient and get more people involved. And if we throw in the towel because we've had a bad squash harvest, that isn't going to help that in any way. So, obviously, our strength lies in diversity and on every level.
Mm-hmm.
So, with crops, yes, we've had a bad squash harvest. We've got some, a lot less than I wanted. But we have had, as I mentioned earlier, an amazing rainbow chard harvest, a really good onion harvest. We've got an amazing salad crop at the moment. We've had a good tomato harvest. And we've had other things which have been quite good. Some have been really good, some have been very poor. And if you have a diversity of crops every year, if some fail, the others will back it up.
Right.
And next year it might be that those ones fail, but your squashes are amazing next year and they'll back it up.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got all your eggs in one basket, so to speak,
yeah,
and your egg harvest fails, then you're stuffed. But if you have that big diversity across the board, something will always be there to back you up.
Yeah.
Just as an aside on this, I don't know if Hugh is aware of how the volunteers here kind of assess Hugh's mood on any day. we talk about, oh, Hugh's really sad today, something's happened, I just think you're incredibly stoic, because it can't be easy when you lose something. Or I know you've talked about the diversity, but it is, just to go back to kind of Hugh's responsibility,
right,
and the fact we're all quite sensitive to when things go well or when things don't go well, and the fact that you might look a bit upset one day because something maybe hasn't gone so well, and then you just spring back again.
Yeah, you can't fight nature. Farming is working, should be working with nature,
mm-hmm.
rather than trying to fight against it.
Right.
And nature throws a lot of stuff at you, but you've got to roll with it. I mean, we have a very, very nature-friendly farm here. Which is one of the beautiful things about being here. I mean, the UK is one of the most nature-depleted countries in the world,
mm-hmm.
with one in six species threatened with extinction as we speak. And the amount of nature that we see here on the farm, because of the way we farm it, we see barn owls, I see foxes, I've seen stoats and weasels and a heron.
Polecats?
Polecats, red kites, buzzards, kestrels. The kestrel here every day.
Do you have badgers here?
Never seen a badger on the farm.
Oh, okay.
They're in the local area because I walk past their poo on the way home every day.
Okay. We have them in our garden.
But you've got to work with that, and if the nature wasn't here, it would be a lot sadder place to work than it is at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the nature does help you in your work. I mean, when I first came, I went around the farm collecting ladybirds and put them in the polytunnel to eat the aphids. And I did that for the first couple of years, and I don't have to do it anymore because now there's a ladybird population in the polytunnels. And we've put a couple of ponds in to encourage frogs to eat the slugs. They could eat a lot more slugs, to be honest, especially this year. But we're trying to work with nature as we farm.
Sounds like an environment where, you know, if you are in a down space, that there is enough here that if you just switch on to the positivity that's here, there is a lot of positivity that you can draw from.
Yes. Yeah, from the land and from the nature and from the people involved.
Which goes back to the beginning, this sort of tripod effect that is foundational to the farm, or the community farm.
And for every failure you have here, there's at least one success to balance it out.
Cool. On that note, are there any motivational quotes that you actually respond to or use on those days that present themselves as more difficult?
My usual quote on those days is from a book I once read called The Farm, and it said, "If it seems like it's too easy, you're doing it wrong."
Oh, really?
So it's kind of mocking, in that if you're having a bad day,
yeah,
it's telling you
that's a good
that
one.
You're having a bad day for a reason.
That's great.
Another book I'm a very practical person, and I've got a practical book which is called Grow Your Own Vegetables by Joy Larkham, and I use that book constantly. It's an amazing book. It's so well thumbed now. It's like half soil, half book. That's the book I have in my office.
It's another name for a band.
And that book is so full of practical tips. There's more in that book than I will ever know.
Really?
But then farming down here in Cornwall, I think Joy Larkham, when she wrote the book, she was in East Anglia.
Okay.
And we're down here in Cornwall, so we've got to change it ever so slightly when we look at it.
Any last thoughts, Rebecca, on if you have anything?
There was just one thing I want to say, which I have to come in elsewhere.
Okay.
Very, very quickly. One of the things that really moves me when I'm volunteering here in the fields is the diversity of the people that I'm volunteering with. And when I'm talking about diversity, I'm talking about nationality, but I'm talking about age and ability.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting to watch how Hugh needs to manage people and make sure that everybody has a task that's appropriate to them.
Yeah.
And it all feels just really harmonious, like we're all volunteering together, but quite a lot goes into making sure that that is smooth and everyone feels like they're contributing. And I just love that about this place.
Well, that's like the students that we're in today. You said their specialty, they just love digging
and wheelbarrows.
Yeah. And so just filling that hole for the day with them.
Yeah, they wouldn't be very good at picking salad leaves. Or should I say, they might be very good at it, but they wouldn't enjoy it.
Right.
They'd much rather be digging up potatoes or shifting compost.
And you know, neurodiversity as well, neurodivergence. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting observing that here on the farm.
But
yeah,
that's kind of where I was going, was like, because people are volunteering not all, but some, that there is, like, do you find having to plug people in or do they elect to sort of like, well, I'd like to do this, and then because that'll make them happy doing that project or that.
Everyone's different.
Yeah, part of the job. So you have people that may enjoy working in the market, in the store, versus people that want to be out in the field on their knees picking.
Mm-hmm.
Something like
other
that.
Other people who want to be behind a computer, and other people want to be behind a steering wheel.
So for you, is that something you're also navigating? Is there's a team behind that that's helping out with you on that?
There's a team of us who are into that, working out people's strengths and where they can be most useful.
Okay.
I organise the people out in the field, but I do get help with people if they want to be in the shop, if they want to be doing the admin, clerical organisation, open day kind of side, then there's other people in the organisation who will take them on board with that.
Okay. So if people want to become part of this field to fork process, ethos, philosophy, there's lots of opportunity if they go to the website.
Go to the website, get in touch, drop us an email. You can send a message through the website. You can also sign up for a VegBox on the website as a form to fill out if you want to support the work that we do here on the farm. You can support us by subscribing to a VegBox online.
And there's no commitment to that. Somebody could order one, try it out, and if they don't like it, or is there a minimum commitment?
There's a button you can click for a one-off trial.
Ah, well, there
you
go.
And they'll just get one VegBox, or they can sign up for a year, or people don't really sign up for a year, they just sign up ongoing. It can weekly or fortnightly.
Right.
Or they can just dip in and dip out, try it as they seem, as they feel like. They can just have one.
Mm.
They can be with us for 10 years.
And I know you deliver. I've never asked what the region is. How far, what's your furthest drop?
Furthest drop's probably Carbis Bay.
Oh, okay.
Which is 14 miles away.
Right, right. Or they can pick up here at the farm.
They can pick up here at the farm.
On Friday.
Yeah, on Friday we have one.
And you also have a market stall?
Two market stalls a week.
Two?
Two. Oh, okay. One at Senon on a Tuesday morning and one in St. Just on a Saturday morning.
So much going on.
So much. It's
so
difficult
much.
To keep track.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, well, well done you both and well done to the farm. It's just amazing to hear how much is actually produced and you know, not just in food or produce, but in all the tasks that are there. So, yeah, thank you very much for today. Thank you, Rebecca. You. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl.
Great.
It's been fun.
Hello, we're at the Dog and Rabbit, where we're sitting speaking with Rosie. Hugh mentioned your cafe in our interview about Field Fork. Rosie, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
That's great. Thanks for coming on. Can you give us a bit of a background on the Dog and Rabbit?
It began as a project, a real love child of Ali Richer.
Okay.
So she bought the building and she created the cafe. So all of the sort of original ethos is kind of her dream, and a lot of the decor and everything, all the lovely cozy furniture is down to her. And I worked for her for a while, and then she wanted to pass it on. And I think we were both a really good fit for each other because I loved a lot of the stuff that she did originally, and I've continued a lot of that and tried to keep going, you know, making positive changes and doing the best we can the whole time. I think that's really the fundamental values behind the cafe.
Okay. Can you, you know, in a sentence or two, describe what sort of the ethos is of
well,
the cafe?
The like using Bosavan Farm and all of the local veg that we can find.
Mm-hmm.
We're really lucky that we've got the farms locally. We try not to buy out of season ingredients if we can ever. I mean, there are a few things that we have to get, but I think using local seasonal ingredients is probably one of the most important things about the cafe.
Okay. And when was it established?
So I think we're into our seventh year now, me and
really?
Ben. So Ali had it for 5 years before that.
Okay.
So that would be 12.
12 years.
Maths isn't my strong point, but I think I can do that one.
Terrific. One of the questions we like to ask our guests is, what is your favorite vegetable? And how do you like to prepare it? So what would that be for you?
That's quite interesting. Well, I think my favorite vegetable would have to change.
Okay.
Compared with the seasons. Because obviously when spring comes along, you've got to love tomatoes and cucumbers.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the winter, I really like the change, actually. But if I had to pinpoint one, I'll maybe go for a cauliflower.
That's one of my favorites.
It's very versatile, and it's so delicious. And you can just eat it as it is. You can't go wrong with a cauliflower.
So this, as I said, this episode is exploring Field to Fork. So I've come to understand The field to fork includes not only the care in growing the food, paying attention to minimal soil disturbance, relying on no chemicals in the growing process or limited chemicals, keeping the time between harvest to sale at a minimum for freshest and most nutritious product. But there's also a socio-psychological element through community engagement on and off the farm, and keeping distribution distance and knowledge focused locally while being part of the global vision. All of which extends beyond product numbers and focusing on less carbon and pollution production. Sorry, let me say that again. As a business serving the product, what does field to fork mean to you? I know that was a bit long-winded.
I totally get it, though. I mean, I agree with that whole statement.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. I think I might add as well that I really think the seasonal aspect is really important as well. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the fork side of things, we should be eating what's growing in the field at that time.
Right.
And I think trying to stick to seasonal produce is really important in, mm-hmm. in globally and locally and personally.
Right. So as a business, obviously you're a clientele. We have tourists, big tourist season in St.
Yep.
Just in the summer. What happens in the winter? That tourist season kind of, it does die off or slow down.
Well, we're
but
really
still
lucky in St. Just because it's still a working town.
Right.
It's still, I mean, the holiday aspect of things is a factor, but we've got quite a good local community that are here all year round, and actually when the tourists go away they come back out with the woodwork again, so
yeah, it reminds
quite a good balance.
Me I part of my life was spent on a little island off of Vancouver called Bowen Island.
Wow.
And when I walked in here I felt very close.
Did you?
It resembled and reminded me very intimately of that restaurant or that cafe in
really
on
nice.
Bowen Island. And that island too, summer the population goes up 50-60%.
Yeah.
Winter it goes down. And the same thing, the locals come out.
Yeah.
Then.
I think everybody sort of who lives here takes a bit of a back seat in the summer and then they sort of venture out again in the autumn. Mm.
But why I ask that question is, I guess because adjusting to the seasonality of the food, you just roll with, you don't go with what's popular, or I guess the question is, do you go with what's popular, what is known, or do you just react? Because obviously if you're connected to the farm as intimately as you are, there'll be good seasons and bad seasons for certain fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
So you have to react to that, I guess.
I don't know if that's so much to do with the tourist season as, again, to do with the seasons in general, because I think in the summer we just can't make enough salads.
Right, okay.
So salads just fly out all day long. And in that sense, storage space is our biggest issue because we just haven't got anywhere to keep it.
Mm-hmm.
So Boss Seven very kindly give us 2 deliveries a week, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
That's another thing about being so close to your food is that we can have that kind of relationship where they're very flexible with us and accommodating.
Is part of that locality and that distance connected very much for you as part of the business idea, the freshness of it and the
Absolutely.
Nutrition?
Yes,
mm.
100%.
And does that transfer, do you find your customers responding to that?
I think so. I mean, I work in the kitchen more than I do front of house, so I don't speak to a whole lot of customers, but we try to create conversations as much as we can. So I like to try and tell everybody. So, for example, when I write the soup board, I will write the name of the supplier.
Oh, really?
So if it's Boss Seven squash soup, then I will write Boss Seven squash soup. And sometimes people don't know what Boss Seven is, so that's really nice because then we can tell them and we can talk about it.
Oh, that's
a great
idea.
Which is great for us and for them.
Right.
And for Boss Seven, hopefully.
So is the soup named after the place, or is it just part of the sort of the information?
Just part of the information. So I'll... I'll say with Boss Seven leaf, green leaf garnish,
mm-hmm.
something like that. If it comes as a side,
right?
Yeah, from a community point of view, obviously that's fantastic, and we have a really good relationship with all the people who work there.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we get to know them when they stay around a bit longer.
Right.
Lil works for us here, and she also works at the farm, so that's really nice because we hear
Lilith?
Okay. Yeah, so we get to swap stories and info about each other.
Right.
So, I mean, it's really tied into the community in a huge way.
And that's been from the beginning when you go back to the original owner?
Yes.
Or did that change with your ownership?
It's definitely changing, but it has always been a really integral part of the community, but it's growing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I go to the farm myself, I see a lovely new painted sign, or, you know what I mean, the shop looks incredible these days.
Right.
So I guess in that sense it's changing, but in a good way.
But I also meant for your restaurant.
I think this happens really good for innovation.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of new things that they try to do, we can then take ideas from that and try to do it as well. I try not to get complacent about anything,
right,
because I think it's really important to keep trying to do more. Well, Savin's really good at giving us a really wide variety of beautiful salad leaves, which you just can't beat anywhere else.
Right. What is local? Like, that's a question I've been starting to think of. Is local within a certain radius of 10, 20, 25 miles?
I think if you're talking about veg, it's got to be within a handful of miles.
Okay, that's interesting.
I think obviously, if I talk about beans and pulses,
yeah,
I would probably consider local as European, which is a wider band.
Yeah.
But I guess that's something that you take, you assume.
Mm-hmm. But if it was available here,
I would get
more
it
easily. You would buy
here
direct from
yeah
your local source.
I mean, you can get British beans and pulses now, which is great. I do that when I can, but I think European is also better again than sort of halfway across the world.
It's like minimizing the steps, or taking or subtracting as many that you can from being involved on a global scale.
Yeah. I mean, we're really lucky. I mean, our other local suppliers, we get coffee that's roasted in Penryn, so we call them a local supplier, but obviously they get their coffee beans from halfway across the world.
Yeah.
But then they ship them with a sailing boat, which is just excellent, isn't it? It's epic. So
really?
There's a couple of sailing boats that take cargo, like really old school style, and it's beautiful.
Never heard of that.
Yeah. That's this coffee. It's good coffee.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So that's
so Julia, my wife's in the background talking about how wonderful the coffee is.
It's brilliant.
It's coffee, really good coffee. Yeah. So they are called Yalla, Yallah, and the roastery is based in Penryn.
Okay.
So it's sort of interesting when talking about local, because obviously that is a local company to us, but they get their beans from Ethiopia and Brazil.
Right.
But they ship them over by sailboat.
Yeah.
Which is a way of being non-local and like minimizing the sort of global
footprint
cost.
Yeah. And that's, I'm going back to what Hugh and Rebecca were talking about, you know, this whole idea of distribution being part of that tripod.
Yeah.
That fits right within it.
I mean, they're doing everything they can, and it's working out really well. And I think also you get a far better product at the end of it, which is another real plus for.
This is my dilemma about when I think about things. It's just like, well, you either hammer on consumerism, and you just cut everything out, and you only go with what is available here, and that's it. So we don't grow coffee here. So if you want to go hardcore, if you want to go hard on this, basically, you know, it'd be no coffee for anyone in the UK.
Yeah.
So you have to find a happy medium. And this sounds like one of those ventures that is a very good happy medium.
And it's another reason to keep trying as well, because you keep trying, keep thinking about it. I think it's really important not to give up. Like, I'm constantly looking for new ways to make things better all the time, and I think that's really important, because you can make good changes all the time. Obviously we get like Cornish tea, so you can grow tea here, which is great. But yeah, like the coffee, I mean, if we stop buying coffee beans, that would probably have a negative effect on the world.
So, exactly.
We don't want to stop doing that, because it's apart from our
I mean, in the global structure of things, that infrastructure, that economic infrastructure, what things, you know, what countries rely on other countries for is very important. So finding a solution that's got the lowest pollution or carbon footprint
but I
is
think
ideal.
It really makes a difference to I think you do notice a difference in your breakfast in a cafe like this. we buy ketchup that's, even little things like the ketchup that we provide is like an organic, high quality, European based ketchup,
right.
Just the little things like that, like the napkins, we use recycled napkins.
Yeah.
So every aspect, I think it's really important to try and be local,
mm-hmm.
as possible, mm-hmm. as local as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that makes it better at the end, mm-hmm. product.
I think one of the maybe myths you could dispel is, how does that affect bottom line and price? So if a consumer walks into here, a client walks into here, a customer walks into here, are they expecting to pay a lot more for the quality that you're talking about, same or less?
It's something that we always worry about. It's actually quite stressful worrying about price and cost of things, because especially since COVID,
mm-hmm.
because prices for us have just doubled.
Sure.
In every way, but we can't double the prices on the menu.
But that's, I think we've seen that across the board,
yeah,
right?
The
even if
everybody.
You go to a large
fast food
restaurant.
And I think everybody understands that as well, so it's not something we need to explain. I think people appreciate that.
They don't like it. None of us like it.
But when it comes to using better ingredients and paying more for them,
mm-hmm.
I fundamentally think that you can tell the difference. Again, it's the product. So I think people come here and they, even if it costs us a bit more, I think that means that we have a consistent client base, like a mm-hmm. consistent customer flow.
Yeah.
I think that makes people want to come here, because they know that we're not going to, you're going to get good ingredients. You know it's going to be in the cakes. You know you're going to have organic grains.
How do you think your ethos trickles down to the customer? What do they take away other than eating a good meal?
Well, I know when I'm a customer, I'm really inspired by other people who do the best they can in these, where they can.
Mm-hmm.
So that really inspires me, and I like to, if I see someone else doing something really great, I'll use that idea.
Right.
I think it's really easy to get disillusioned these days,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's really comforting to meet people who
share and hope,
who are active in who are positive about
mm-hmm.
making better choices.
Right. Just on the tourist front, do you know do you have an idea of the variety of countries that come visit St. Just?
We've had, do you know what, it's funny, you seem to get trends, different countries. I mean, I've met lots of Germans this year.
Yeah, Germans were heavy.
A couple of years ago, there were lots of people from Japan, which was really nice.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite unusual. We've had Americans, Canadians. I think the conversations are great. So
mm-hmm.
I think that's a really nice thing to swap values with different people.
Right.
As well as like the physical things, like the products and the way we do things. I think it's really nice to swap how you think and feel about things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you can. I mean, it becomes part of the memory, right? Like, when Julia and I went to Vancouver, there's a restaurant in Vancouver that reminds us of this place. And we were talking about this the other day, and it was just like, we could not believe that... When did we go? 10 years ago? About 10 years ago we were there? And we could not believe that how strong the memory of that restaurant still sticks.
Nice.
So the feeling, the space, the food, the atmosphere... the people. It really had a sticking point.
It's like the opposite of a social media bubble, isn't it? It's like getting out there and seeing stuff that's really different to you, and then sort of mixing that all together, which is great, because then you get the best of everything.
Because I can see people coming, here, and it's very warm. It just feels really
cozy.
Yeah. And it's not... There's nobody in here really on their phones.
No.
What on the menu do you feel encapsulates the sort of Field to Fork ethos the most?
It's got to be the salad.
Salad.
The super salad. Yeah, it changes with the seasons.
Okay.
There are a few staple ingredients that I buy from the next most local wholesaler, but other than that, it's just what we get delivered.
Right. And what makes that superior for you?
I try and include all of the food groups.
Okay.
So it's got, we usually use quinoa or wild rice for carbohydrate, and then we've got beans. Right. I use edamame beans, which are French edamame beans. So they're...
And is that, I know you're going to have a dish that we're going to photograph in a bit. Is that what we're going to be photographing?
I think so. I think it's very dog and rabbit representative.
Well, we look forward to that.
Very Boissevin representative.
Okay.
So at the moment, we're using more roasted veg, and we'll probably use more roasted veg throughout the winter. But in the summer, there's lots of cucumbers and tomatoes and peppers. Actually, we're still getting peppers at the moment, so that's nice, local peppers. Yeah, it's really special. So yeah, I try and make it nutritionally round and whole. So edamame beans are like a whole protein, so that's really nice. And then there's...
And is that your department? Are you like the chef and figuring out
ingredients? I wouldn't call it chefing, but I'm very interested in food and cooking.
Okay, but you're the architect of the dishes.
Of this, yeah.
Okay. Oh, neat. So what's in season now then that's popular? Squash?
Well, we're just starting to get all the root veg.
Right.
So I think we'll have... But at the moment we're getting squashes, but I think coming soon, and beetroots actually. Beetroots are amazing. I love beetroots. That's probably actually another favourite.
Well, it's been a real pleasure having you come on board and hearing from your perspective how the food is used and sort of the experiences and stuff that takes place here in St. Justin in your cafe seasonally. I think I take that away from this conversation is the importance of the seasonality and the nimbleness that you apply.
Nice. That's nice.
With a creative endeavor.
Yeah.
And fever. Fever? Uh-oh. All's okay.
Just yeah.
That's not a warning
general,
shot.
General drama every day.
We're
really passionate about the food, so it's really lovely to chat about it and really love what we get from Boissevin.
Great. It's been really a treat speaking with you
and
hearing
you.
Your enthusiasm
really nice.
Come out.
I've surprisingly quite enjoyed myself.
Well, that's good to know.
No, it's lovely talking about it all.
Yeah.
Terrific. Well, it's genuine, so that kind of...
Well, I feel it. If you're here looking at Rosie right now, you'd see the glow in her eyes and her smile. Thank you very much.
It's not just the coffee.
No. Thank you very much, Rosie.
Thank you very much.